field of psychedelics research has exploded in recent years as scientists dig deeper into the neuroscience and pharmacology of hallucinogens and how their unique properties can be harnessed to understand and treat depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, Alzheimer's disease, dementia, and other neurodegenerative diseases. Remarkably, the human body produces its own endogenous psychedelics, the reasons for which have implications for understanding the ordinary and extraordinary states of human consciousness, from creativity and dreaming to near-death experiences. Welcome to The Scientist Speaks, a podcast produced by the Scientist Creative Services team. Our podcast is by scientists and for scientists. Once a month, we bring you the stories behind newsworthy molecular biology research. In this episode, Iris Klobotsky from The Scientist spoke with Stephen Barker, a professor emeritus at Louisiana State University, to learn more about the human body's ability to produce hallucinogenic compounds and their roles in physiological processes.
The history of hallucinogen research has a long and winding path, one that Stephen Barker has walked for over 50 years. During this time, he has contributed seminal research findings about the presence and roles of endogenous hallucinogens in the mammalian brain, and watched the field evolve from prohibitive government interventions to the thriving initiative it is today. His main research interests have been identifying dimethyltryptamine, or DMT, a serotonergic psychedelic, in various tissues, defining its proposed role as a neurotransmitter and developing new ways to detect and quantify it. Having grown up in the 50s, Barker's interest in science and psychedelics research specifically was sparked by his vivid recurring dreams, an epiphany he had while taking a course on natural products, and an interest in the hippie movement, specifically the recreational use of psychedelic drugs.
In the 50s, it was a very conservative and a little bit socially backward time. I used to have very elaborate dreams. I wondered where that was from. I would hear, mainly because of the religious South that I was growing up, about people having visions and speaking to dead, have God visit them, and near-death experience as proof of another world. I was very curious, what exactly was this? I was not entirely accepting of the answers given by organized religion. In 1972, while I was taking the course under Dr. Fred Bennington at the University of Alabama in Birmingham in natural products, one of the main chapters was hallucinogens. As an aside, Dr. Bennington said, "We're studying the natural occurrence of hallucinogens in humans," and that they had identified hallucinogens in the cerebral spinal fluid of schizophrenic patients. It's the closest thing I've ever experienced to an epiphany, a sudden insight. Oh, this explains so much of what I've been curious about, if that the human brain normally produces hallucinogenic drugs. I was already aware from my chemistry background, about how they acted, what their pharmacology was. I had to try them myself, of course. You can't speak in a authoritative way about things unless you've actually tried them. But that was my excuse. In that experience and what others reported and the information in the scientific literature and Dr. Bennington's information that these were found in the brains of schizophrenics, and they were pursuing whether or not it was actually a cause or a symptomology, a related compound in that process. I had to do that kind of research. I just had to. I was interested in the human brain. I have been convinced not only by the provable scientific data, but by the possibilities that such a compound would have for understanding the mind of mankind.
As a PhD student in 1976, Barker began studying endogenous hallucinogens, those produced naturally in mammals. Over the decade that followed, however, the psychedelics research environment became less permissive. Barker, like many other scientists, struggled to secure adequate research funding, in part because of government decisions to tighten restrictions on drug research as part of the War on Drugs initiative. As a result, many scientists moved on to pursue other research programs that were higher up on the list of national grant funding priorities. Barker was a rare exception, continuing to pursue his passion for hallucinogen research until the research environment once again became more permissive. Rick Strassman, a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine, played a pivotal role in the revival of psychedelic research when he initiated a government-funded project in 1990 to study the effect of psychedelics in humans.
I ended up funding my own programs. What really changed was when Rick Strassman in 1993 got the idea that he could conduct some administration studies with DMT. The conditions were starting to change. Interest was starting to come back. But he fought very long to get the funding permission. The studies that were done by Rick in the 90s set the wheels in motion again. And little by little, it started to gain momentum. Work that was being done in other laboratories at that time added to that impetus because it was being discovered that the pharmacology of hallucinogens was of far greater interest than the psychedelic effect. Slowly, the machinery of the institutions, you know, the bureaucracy, started to break to allow funding for those areas. And now we're starting to reap the benefits. A whole new pharmacology for this class of compounds has been discovered, and we're getting more insights every day into how these compounds normally function, that they are present as endogenous compounds of regulatory interest for different issues related to the brain.
Over the years, Barker has witnessed a revival of interest in many of the same research questions his seminal work addressed decades earlier. For example, based on the endogenous hallucinogen data that he gathered during his PhD, Barker proposed that DMT was in fact a neurotransmitter that played an important role in understanding human perception, including various ordinary states of consciousness such as dream states, creativity, imagination, as well as extraordinary states of consciousness such as those experienced during disease or under extreme physiological states. But why would such a system be required in the first place? Seminal studies that examined the fluctuation of DMT in response to stress helped address this question. Barker's colleagues at the University of Alabama in Birmingham housed juvenile rats apart from one another. Being social animals, such isolation is both psychologically and physically stressful. They measured DMT levels in group-housed versus isolated rats using mass spectrometry and found that group-housed rats had nearly undetectable DMT levels in the brain and adrenal glands, whereas isolated rats had significantly higher DMT concentrations. They showed that DMT occurred endogenously in the brain and adrenal glands, and its fluctuation in response to stress suggests that it is under regulatory control.
The fight or flight response, particularly the adrenal producing fairly high concentrations of DMT when animals were placed under stress, is probably part of that process. If there is a chance of injury, you would want to protect, you know, the most valuable organ, the brain. In that fight or flight response, a number of neurotransmitters go up tremendously, much like the near-death experience, where that same kind of phenomena has been observed. DMT has a role to play, you know, in that process. It's not that we have hallucinogens naturally occurring in our brains to have a perpetual state of psychedelic experience. Although, for many centuries, philosophers speculated that it's all hallucination anyway. There's a lot of science that, in a manner, supports that concept. The process of perception of taking in external stimuli in the forms of different types of energy and processing that to produce knowable information that we use to do everything, that there had to be some regulatory system for that. And the only class of compounds that we know of that so dramatically and specifically affected perception were the hallucinogens. Our further study of that might help us understand when it all goes wrong, or how we might enhance it to make things go even better, yeah, than what we normally experience.
Given the fact that DMT can protect neurons and increase the growth of neuronal dendrites in the brain, Barker and his like-minded colleagues believe that it may act to support neuronal damage that occurs as a result of reactive oxygen species and other destructive processes triggered by stress. Sufficiently elevated levels of DMT under extremely stressful conditions such as cardiac arrest may induce dissociative and hallucinatory states of consciousness.
You can see if tissues undergo hypoxia due to cardiac arrest or any other thing that produces hypoxia, a compound that can protect neurons from hypoxic damage and help heal that damage would be quite useful at that point. Since humans have been around, we've probably undergone such states in near death or extreme physiological conditions. Dr. Strassman had postulated that this was possible, that the pineal pumped out this compound. It's one of those great examples of how a hypothesis can lead to such tremendous amounts of research. He scientifically stuck his neck out, put forward the explanation that it could be related to near-death experience and other fantastical states of consciousness. And he caught some flack for it. But little by little, the field has started to accept that this is probably what's going on. Some recent papers have actually said that an endogenous psychedelic could provide these types of service to the body, and that we have missed out all these years by not having examined.
Where other researchers have shied away from contemplating the scientific basis of near-death experiences, Barker acknowledges them as a fundamental part of human experience and as closely related to psychedelic experiences in response to hallucinogenic drugs. Individuals who undergo near-death experiences describe it as a very real occurrence that very often causes a transformative change in their personality and perspective on life. Similarly, individuals who participate in controlled research studies of DMT administration subjectively describe dramatic breakthrough experiences that mimic near-death descriptions.
In administering DMT, typically people experience rapidly moving geometric figures and fractals. If you're familiar with the artist M.C. Escher, one would think that he's probably had DMT before. Then they experience another reality, and sometimes that occurs through a tunnel or going into a bright light. You're in a separate reality, and some say things are more clear. In that place, they may interact with long-lost relatives, dead ones, with spirit guides and entities. What people report in near death is the same kind of thing. They have this dissociative state where they may float above their body. Then they start going into this tunnel-like feature, into a bright light, then in another world, which most people associate with whatever their religious beliefs are. Heaven, nirvana, all of the different religions have basically the same definition of what happens. There was just a study where they were able to record people's brain activity as they were dying. It demonstrated that, one, the brain doesn't turn off. It goes through a burst of activity in areas of the brain, particularly the frontal cortex and the dissociative and associative areas of the brain where these experiences would be occurring. That happens with hallucinogen administration as well. There's almost exact overlay between imaging studies of what happens to the brain on administration of something like DMT and what happens in death, the process of death.
In another foundational study, Burkhardt and his colleagues perfused artificial cerebrospinal fluid through the rat brain pineal gland, collected the perfusate, and performed liquid chromatography and mass spectrometry analysis to determine whether DMT and its metabolites and precursors were present. This technique was previously widely used to measure serotonin, dopamine, and other neurotransmitters in the brain. In this context, researchers repeatedly saw a peak in the analytics data that they couldn't identify. Burkhardt and his colleagues showed that DMT was present in the brain perfusate samples in comparable concentrations to other neurotransmitters. Yet, a debate emerged regarding the functional relevance of the minute concentrations of endogenous psychedelics in the brain. Critics pointed out that the concentrations of these compounds were not high enough to exert a hallucinogenic state, according to the blood levels that are needed to induce hallucinations. Barker maintains that despite the tiny concentrations of endogenous psychedelics, their presence has an important function.
The work of Bob Harrison, where you get concentrations in the brain over 500 nanomolar, which is well above the level required to induce a psychedelic state, or the levels that were seen in adrenal gland, which would be physiologically active. There was also a study done in 1984 by Dr. John Beaton, who was at the UAB lab at the time I was there, looking at DMT concentrations in developing rat brain. There was a steady state concentration of DMT measurable in the brains of those young animals. And they increase from about 14 to 20 days up to as high as 37 nanomolar in those brains, but had a steady state of 17 nanomolar and then dropped down to undetectable levels at 40 days. Why was that? This compound could be involved in brain development. Although these concentrations were tiny, if you take a tiny amount and put it in a tiny volume, you have high concentrations. So small amounts, what appear to be tiny volumes, like the concentrations of neurotransmitters in the synaptic cleft, can have neurophysiological activity and can reach concentrations that produce hallucinations.
Burkhardt believes that thanks to the latest technology and an increased permissiveness to study psychedelics, there is now irrefutable evidence that DMT is in fact a neurotransmitter, supporting his own long-held belief that this compound is an essential neurotransmitter with far-reaching roles in the body, including cell signaling and neuroprotection. There was evidence as far back as the 1970s to this effect, but it was largely ignored by the scientific community.
1974, Dr. Samuel T. Christian, who was at the neuroscience program at UAB, he and his colleagues had shown that DMT had all the properties of a neurotransmitter. Right? It could be biosynthesized. The enzymes were identified. It could be taken up into vesicles and stored in the boutons of neurons. It could be released with a signal into the synapse. There were reuptake sites for it. And that it caused a signal to be sent. And there were changes in calcium, phosphate, ATP, and everything that you would expect for your transmitter. That work has been there for a very long time, but we would very seldom see it cited, maybe because he did not publish in the best of journals. But the work had been done, and it was there. The work that we've been doing since that time is to try to make sure that the research field stays vigorous and then try to produce data that shows that these compounds are there, that they have an effect, and that the effects may be something we really need to examine.
Perhaps the most compelling evidence of how endogenous psychedelics do what they do and why they have such unique properties comes from a recent study by researchers at the University of California, Davis, that identified how DMT exerts its effects. DMT is a serotonergic psychedelic, meaning it acts through the same receptors as serotonin, the 5-HT2A receptors. The researchers found that DMT, along with other psychedelics such as psilocybin and LSD, exert their psychoplastogenic and psychedelic effects depending on their polarity, whether they are lipid or water-soluble, and their subsequent ability to bind to 5-HT2A receptors inside cells. They found that a compound exerted greater psychedelic and psychoplastogenic effects if its chemical structure was nonpolar and lipid-soluble, whereas more polar compounds exerted less of these effects. For example, serotonin is highly polar and water-soluble and does not induce hallucinations or have psychoplastogenic properties. The researchers found that 5-HT2A receptors exhibit positional bias, meaning that they are found either within the membrane on the outside of the cell or inside the cell. Receptors on inside of cells could only be activated by compounds like DMT that are lipid-soluble and capable of crossing the cell membrane.
When it does that, it starts a cascade of events that describe the regulatory mechanism and cause for the neuropsychogenic and psychoplastogenic effects. It basically promoted neuroplastogenicity through the activation of intracellular 5-HT2A receptors. It's the same receptor, but now you can start to explain compounds that have effects and compounds that don't have effects by whether it can penetrate the membrane or not. It'll still bind at the same receptor, but it has to go inside the membrane to get to these receptors on the inside that initiate the process of cellular growth, neuronal growth, etc. DMT can rapidly penetrate the membrane. It very rapidly penetrates the blood-brain barrier, which is also a lipophilic barrier. It may be actively transported. And the inside of these neurons, receptors were associated with the Golgi apparatus. The Golgi plays an extremely important role in everything that a cell does, where proteins, receptors, and other regulatory molecules get packaged and delivered, to the proper areas of the cell. These receptors were associated with that process. In order to have neuronal maintenance, repair, and normal activity, these compounds, like DMT, may be binding to affect that process. We see that in the newly discovered pharmacology of the psychedelic.
Barker compares this latest discovery and the process of untangling the science of psychedelics to scientists' gradual understanding of how morphine worked. For many years, researchers were mistaken about the pharmacological mechanism through which morphine exerts its analgesic effect, based on the information they had about the brain at the time. Scientists believed that morphine acted as a painkiller by affecting certain neurotransmitters. What they didn't know at the time was that the human body had its own endogenous morphine receptors that bound to various morphine-like compounds, including the enkephalins, endorphins, and dynorphins, which were also produced endogenously. Morphine acted through these very same receptors.
Same case here. We've always looked at the mode of action of the hallucinogens by what effect they have on the neurotransmitters we know about. Serotonin, dopamine, GABA, and NMDA, and other receptors and neurotransmitters that these compounds interact with. There are volumes of data, but there were compounds that behaved in a very similar way that had absolutely no capacity to produce hallucinations. They were similar in structure, or they were even very different in structure, but had the same action on these receptors. The main receptor that was focused on was the 5-hydroxytryptamine or serotonin receptor. It has 14 different receptors. The main one was dubbed 5-HT2A. The ability for DMT to bind that receptor was respectable, but it still didn't explain how these phenomena were being produced. When the pharmacology of it being a neuroplastogenic agent, a psychoplastogen, being a neuroprotectant came along, it was obvious that there was something else going on there. It was proposed that it was the endogenous ligand for the sigma-1 receptor, which is involved in neurogenesis as a protectant. But the concentration required was quite high. So it still didn't explain everything.
Barker emphasizes that endogenous psychedelics exist in the body to regulate ordinary experiences. Their normal role is not to produce extraordinary states of consciousness or hallucinations, but rather that such extraordinary states of consciousness can be reached when the levels of these compounds rise in response to certain physiological conditions. Other conditions, aside from hallucinogens, can induce altered states of consciousness, such as sensory deprivation, meditation, and certain ritualistic dances that require extreme focus and repetition, and can lead to substantial physical changes. For example, certain meditative states can lead to partial hypoxia and subtle regulation of DMT levels. Under more extreme exertion, such as ritualistic dancing, the body may even experience a state of exhaustion, which is a significant stressor and may lead to higher levels of DMT release. Even common experiences within the context of everyday life, such as sleep and dream states, have the potential to alter the concentration of endogenous DMT, and along with it, the subtle neurochemical balances needed to maintain so-called normal states of consciousness.
The binding of these compounds to internal 5-HT2A receptors and perhaps some others may be helpful in treating neurodegenerative diseases, Alzheimer's, dementia, brain damage that occurs from accidents and other stressors or events, that they may be a class of compounds we can now turn over to medicinal chemistry. There was a paper that showed if they took the dimethylethylamine side chain off of DMT and moved it around to the nitrogen part of the indole ring and made an iso-DMT, that compound still penetrates the membrane and has the plastogenic effects, but it's not hallucinogenic. So what does that say about the hallucinogenic process? Well, these compounds bind at the external HT and internal 5-HT. And what I proposed in a paper I've submitted for publication just recently is that the endogenous ligand for the hallucinogenic properties of these compounds is dimethyltryptamine. It is DMT. That's a normal neurotransmitter, and its receptor is the intracellular 5-HT. It produces this psychedelic effect through interaction with both the external and the internal, producing an increase in interconnections between different areas of the brain that are clearly shown on neuroimaging studies that activate areas of the brain that can be readily associated with the hallucinogenic experience. This is a endogenous hallucinogen neuronal system, which I proposed in 1981. We're finally getting some information that starts to put this story together. This is a very important system and pathway to understanding how the brain delivers to us our sense of reality, how we regulate perception, creativity, imagination, dream states, extraordinary states of consciousness.
Barker's powerful and recurrent dreams as a child continue to guide his scientific work and personal interests. He continues to push the limits of scientific knowledge by asking important questions about life, death, and all the ordinary and extraordinary experiences that constitute being human. Barker foresees a future where the scientific truths behind these fundamentally human occurrences are given the attention they deserve.
I had one recurring dream. I was laying in the bed, and I could see myself from a distance. I would come in close in my pajamas as a kid, about 12 years old. I would rise up and go out the window, up into the skies, right? And I would soar over the steel mills in Birmingham where I lived. I would see fantastic things beneath me, scenes of lush vegetation. The whole time it was happening, I knew it was a dream. I would arrive to this hill, right, that was treeless, and there was a tall Victorian-style house sitting there. I would go in through the front door and start running this spiral staircase, and it would continue to spiral, and it was toward a bright light. I knew that in that light was the answer. Now, I didn't know what the question was, but I knew that if I could get there, I would have an answer. And I would wake up with this question, with this conclusion that I had reached in my own mind that I would never know. And that's what's driven me. We have been historically held back by people who believed that they had the answer. Science is the only field that you can't really believe in something unless it can be reproducibly proven. It's okay not to believe. It's okay to try to disprove what other people believe. Once you realize that you've made a mistake, you acknowledge that mistake and you move on with new information. That's the only way we are continuing the process of discovery and of knowledge, instead of stopping and saying, oh no, this explains it. This is where we are. No need to look further. I've always been against that kind of attitude. I never know when I've finished with a subject. The best kind of research generates more questions than it answers.
Thank you for listening to The Scientist Speaks. This episode was produced by the Creative Services team for The Scientist and narrated by Iris Klobotsky. Please join us again in April as we learn about how researchers use explainable AI to gain mechanistic insights through high-throughput biological datasets. To keep up to date with this podcast, follow The Scientist on social media and subscribe to The Scientist Speaks wherever you get your podcasts.